Well, thank you very much again for inviting me here. And I remember Thierry coming to Stockholm about 10 years ago. It's nice to be a source of inspiration for the long and the short form of the protein here. So I will give you now some things which we have done and some thoughts after listening to the presentations here. The thyrodoxin and glutaridoxin systems were both discovered and are very much present today in principle all cells, namely with the ribonucleotide reductase, which is an enzyme reducing all four ribonucleotides to deoxyribonucleotides, and it makes DNTP for DNA synthesis can be replication, like in a T cell where you make perhaps 100,000 nucleotides per second in order to copy the billions of base pairs in DNA. Or it can be DNA repair, which goes on all the time, that you have two different forms of DNA repair, and then there is a specific subunit of so-called P53R2. Now, the enzyme is famous, of course, for being containing a free radical in the R2. And my aspect of ribonucleotide reductase is always that every time you turn over this enzyme, if you make one deoxyribose in the DNTP here, you go a turn here because you make a disulfide in the enzyme. The enzyme mechanism results in an internal disulfide in the enzyme. The enzyme has a swinging arm, which is in the R1 subunit, which is the target of thyrodoxin or glutaridoxin. And the glutathione glutaridoxin system is one possibility here. If you knock out in E. coli or in fact in our mammalian cells, thyrodoxin, you live on this system. And I think one of the things I have been working on lately is that, yes, you have to get both these systems working, particularly for DNA repair. If you have problems with electrons from these two systems, you have replication stress because the enzyme don't get electrons. But that's not exactly what we focus on today. You have seen this picture many times before, I'm sure. The thyrodoxin reductase in our cells is a selenoenzyme, actually three different enzymes, and thyrodoxin in the cytosol is one specific gene. Mitochondria have their own system. And it is a general protein disulfide reductase with many functions. But thyrodoxin is also external. And around 1990, several groups discovered thyrodoxin as a cytokine and an extracellular protein with interesting activities on cell growth. And among these things was also the truncated form of thyrodoxin, thyrodoxin 80. Oops. So a very brief summary of redox control by thyrodoxin, and this is mammalian cells particularly, controlling apoptosis, in this case by binding to a kinase, which can initiate apoptosis. Peroxyrhodopsins are very abundant cell cytosol-containing, cysteine-containing peroxidases, which use at least five of them, thyrodoxin, to reduce. And these remove hydrogen peroxide, but also lipid hydroperoxides. DNA binding and activity of transcription factors is controlled by thyrodoxin in the nucleus, and that is like NF-kappa-B or AP1 and so on. NO nitrosylation is a lot by thyrodoxin. In many ways, thyrodoxin is the cell's DTT. DTT is, as you know, many of you, a rather strong and indiscriminate reductant, and thyrodoxin is like that. Of course, it's much more sophisticated, but and so on. thyroxine has its own inhibitor, and we work a little bit on that at the moment. One of the important things is if you knock out thyroxine reductase in cells, in the cytosol, thyroxine still stays reduced. Because if you get oxidized thyroxine, thyroxine disulfide form, cells tend to die. And I believe that is because the reaction with thyroxine is reversible. Thyroxine plant disulfides in proteins, and that is no good. Now, why is thyroxine still reduced in the cytosol if you knock out thyroxine reductase? This can be done genetically, as people in Germany and USA have done, or you can do it by inhibition. Well, we showed that glutathione and glutaredoxine will reduce thyroxine and keep it active. So there's a crosstalk between glutathione and glutaredoxine and the human thyroxine 1. And this is because human thyroxine 1, in contrast to the E. coli protein, has about 35 millivolt higher redox potential. So glutathione comes into play. So there's crosstalk between these two. One of the ideas I got from listening to you is that the long form, we have done, and you have done, a lot of experiments trying thyroxine reductase. But perhaps glutathione glutaredoxine is a reductant for the long form. Yeah. Quickly done to test. Yeah. So let's go on. Thyroxinate became something playing in the immune system. And we started to work on this with Klaus Pekkari, a graduate student, in about 85 maybe, or so, or 90, around 90. And the background is the following. Thyroxine is 104 residues, 105 if you count the first methionine. And this is generated by cleavage at a lysine residue to generate the 81st amino acids here. Importantly, you lack the disulfide reductase activity. The thyroxinate is not a substrate for thyroxine reductase, and of course it's not a disulfide reductant. And it was cloned once upon in Harvard by a group around Silberstein and others who worked on eosinophilic cytotoxicity enhancing factor. When we started to work on this, I decided, no, we can't work on this, because the assay here is larvae or schistosomiasis, which are killed by eosinophils. And this is not what you want to work on. So they purified this and found, actually, they cloned thyroxine out of this and showed that it's the truncated form of thyroxine. So we made recombinant 80. And this shows the blue part here is what is removed in thyroxine 80. That is the terminal helix and the beta strand. And cleavage is here, 80 or 84. Active site of thyroxine exists in all living cells, from bacteria to man. Here, active site, cysteine, glycine, proline, cysteine. There are two cysteines in this molecule here, in the human enzyme. If those are oxidized to disulfide, you lose this helix, the protein aggregates, it's secreted, I believe, goes out from the cell, and it lacks activity. And we have some ideas that this is important for redox signaling hydrogen peroxide. But it's also perhaps the form that is cleaved in a way. This is an old picture which was done in the 80s by together with Kjell Fuchse, a neurobiologist at Karolinska, where we looked at what happens in the brain of a rat when this is the starting point, the whole brain at low resolution, mRNA for thyroxine. Same picture would be if you used an antibody. Big nerve cells have thyroxine in the axons. We showed that it's transported and enriched synaptically. If you make a damage here, like a stroke, you put a knife in here, After 24 hours, you have a strong upregulation of mRNA for thyroxine. It continues for a while, and it takes a week, or after 14 days, you are back to this normal status again. So thyroxine is known to be a factor in regeneration or brain damage, and by partly known or unknown mechanisms. Here is probably thyroxine 80 also. Now the characterization, what we found was if we take PBMC cells, and those are cells you isolate from a blood bank, from normal people, containing monocytes, macrophages, T cells, but no B cells. And you add thyroxine 80, the cells start to grow. So thyroxine 80, pure thyroxine 80, is a growth factor for monocytes. And we call those cells for TAMs. And a long story short, in a very complicated slide, too complicated, in the immune system, the TAMs produce IL-12, and IL-12 in an area where you have NK cells or lymphocytes will produce interferon gamma, and this in the immune system is a Th1 response. It's an inflammatory response. It helps you to remove cells which are cellular immunity. So we have a relatively good feeling here that it is the thyroxine 80 is releasing inflammatory cytokines. It starts a Th1 response. A Th2 response is when you make antibodies. So it's pro-inflammatory. Now, in many years later, during the 2000 here, Susanne Akterin first, and later Angel Sedaso-Menguis, who leads a research group at Huddinge in the Karolinska, headed by Bengt Wimblad, is a very strong center for Alzheimer's research. And the first paper they showed was that thyroxine 80 was decreased in Alzheimer's brains. And I will give you a little bit of this paper is very extensive and nice. And it answers two questions. Is that true that thyroxine 80 is low in Alzheimer's brains? And how do you generate thyroxine 80? So the first thing discovered, in a way, was that many cells, or cells in the brain, in the axons and the neurites, have both thyroxine, thyroxine 80, and it comes out like a 30 kilodalton protein. And if you remember, 80 amino acids is about 10 kilodalton, so it's an aggregated form present in the cells, actually, and in the brain. And the pictures here basically show that if you incubate recombinant thyroxine 80, you can make aggregated forms. It doesn't form fibrils, but it is doing like that. Another result is showing that this is probably due to the fact that the whole thyroxine is this molecule. When you remove the alpha helix and the beta strand, you expose hydrophobic surfaces, which may explain the aggregation phenotype. And here is more detailed analysis of it. It doesn't fibrillate like insulin does. Finally, again, repeating what was done before in a bigger material, Alzheimer brains from a brain bank have low thyroxine 80. And lower, actually also lower thyroxine, but particularly thyroxine 80. And here is more statistics on this, control cells and Alzheimer brains. The damaging species in Alzheimer's is supposed to be A-beta-42, which is done by cleavage consecutively of the amyloid protein, and it shows actually pictures where the thyroxine 80 can bind to A beta and be anti-inflammatory this way. And there is also pictures in this publication showing that we have co-localization of AT and A-beta. Finally, quick things here, thyrodoxin 80 is induced by formal esters. You can see here is before and after formal esters, and you can do various things to understand the secretion here of thyrodoxin, which I won't have time to go into. And finally, the cleavage enzyme is an alpha secretase, ADAM 17, and it can be shown, oops, now I went, oh, it worked, I went too far. It goes forward, okay. So, so actually the ADAM 17 is strongly implicated in cleavage in the membrane of what we believe is oxidized thyrodoxin to release thyrodoxin 80. So very short summary of what I have told you. In the brain instead, thyrodoxin is aggregated, decreased in Alzheimer's disease, and it's clearly anti-inflammatory rather than pro-inflammatory. And the ADAM 17 is implicated in cleavage of thyrodoxin in membranes. Now, in Stockholm, Rajib Sen Gupta was for 5 years a postdoc in my lab from India working on thyrodoxin. And we started a collaboration by Mikael Schlossmacher, who is from Canada, who has a strong project, clinical project on Parkinson's disease. And this is Alzheimer's, which we have just discussed. Parkinson's disease is very much focused on substantia nigra in the brain, a region where dopamine is produced, and the symptoms of Parkinson's disease develop gradually with functional and cognitive problems for the patients, and it has a lot to do with what is believed to be oxidative stress. And we were interested in looking at Parkin, and I will go over this very quickly. Human Parkin is implicated strongly in this disease. The Parkin protein is located in many places, in vesicles and in membranes and so on, all over the cell. It contains a number of domains, and the domains are involved in the activity of Parkin as a ubiquitin ligase involved protein. And the domains here are involved in recognizing substrates and also. And one of the remarkable things with Parkin is that the protein as such has 7.5% of the residues in Parkin are cysteines. There are cysteines in many, many places, as you see here. This is much more than the average protein in our cells, which cysteine may be about 2% or something. So this is more than 7%. And we have been working on mapping out together with Schlossmacher about the reactivity of these proteins. Again, this is textbook material. The function of Parkin is involving removal of modified proteins. And again, the ubiquitin protein ligase taking things to the proteasome here. And these are examples of damaged proteins, particularly in dopamine neurons. You have dopamine can be auto-oxidized and thereby damage cells. It's inherently a damaging molecule, which is very important, of course, for emotional and our way of communication in nerve cells. So this brings me to oxidative stress and the brain. The brain is highly susceptible to oxidative damage. It has a high metabolic rate, 20% of oxygen consumption occurs in the brain. There is metals there, particularly in these neurons, for instance. NO comes into play, and these I've already mentioned here. And the metabolism of dopamine can generate reactive oxygen species and even hydrogen peroxide. And together with metals, you can generate hydroxyl radicals, which are truly damaging. Glutathione is lower in the brain of people with Parkinson's disease. And this is, again, an overview of if you have a protein with an essential or at least an SH group, you can nitrosylate it. You can oxidize to a disulfide. Both these things are under control of thyrodoxine, thyrodoxine reductase. And you can form sulfenic acid or hydrogen peroxide. And here you have the peroxyredoxines. And with glutathione or other things, you can glutathionylate. And glutathionylation is a mechanism where you introduce a glutathione residue as a mixed disulfide in a protein. And glutathione is a tripeptide, which is negatively charged. It has a glutamic acid. So it's like similar to a phosphorylation event. And you change something in the protein when you glutathionylate. But it's reversible by glutathionylation. The glutathionylation is reversible. I think I already said this, so I go over this quickly. Glutathione goes down in Parkinson brains. And when we age, we lose cysteine, we lose glutathione. The cell is normally reduced on the inside, more or less fully reduced on the inside. Now the glutathione system. You can portray the glutathione this way if you want. Glutathione reductase taking electrons from NADPH. Glutathione in the cell normally fully reduced. And if you have GSSG, you may reduce it by the enzyme or you may even pump it out to keep this highly. It must be highly reduced because glutathione is a monothiol. And you must have a high concentration in order to reach a possibility to reduce a protein with a decent redox potential. And then you can, like in ribonucleotide reductase in E. coli, you can use this in a similar way as thyrodoxine. However, in our cells, most of glutathione works by glutathionylating things. It's a mixed disulfide mechanism, and you need only one of the thiols in glutathione active site, actually, to do this, to introduce glutathione as a mixed disulfide. And this can be coupled then to this. We have recently worked out a method whereby we can measure glutathione in a good way, a simple way. If you take glutathione disulfide, this molecule here, you have a disulfide there. You have two amino groups, and you can label those with eosine isothiocyanate, and you get dieosine diglutathione disulfide. The nice thing with this molecule is that it has very low fluorescence, or it has basically no fluorescence if you excite at 520 and look at emission at 545. Because of collisional quenching, the two groups are opposite each other. So the principle of what we do with this is we can always look at eosine glutathione with high fluorescence. And we can use this in two ways. We can measure activity with this, but we can also glutathionylate like Parkin here. So then we take the maltose binding protein in this case, and Parkin, react with this, and we follow the reaction by looking at the formation of free eosine glutathione. And the same for another thing here. And we can look at the opposite. The good thing with this, The good thing with eosine glutathione is that if you put it on a protein, could be albumin or it could be in this case parkin, and you make a mixed disulfide, the quenching again is the same as in the dieosine diglutathione, which is good. And if you put in the glutaroxin complete system, you look upon the release of this thing and you follow activity. I think we can go over this quickly. Here is an example where we have done this. We can follow this on gels also. The same for nitrosylation. We can put parkin with GSNO, which nitrosylates parkin, and we can show that denitrosylation occurs with thyridoxin. About 50% of nitrosylated proteins are denitrosylated by thyridoxin and another half by glutathione itself, or even glutaroxin, which we work on today. So here are some of the people who have been involved in the work, particularly the work of Rajib Sengupta, I have shown, and of course for Parkin, Michael Schlossmacher from Canada, who is also a clinician working with patients. I think one of the key issues here, if I would go back to the start of my talk, is again, I believe that DNA repair and DNA, particularly DNA repair in a situation like you have in the cells in the retina, is also a very important issue here, that you can keep the DNA intact. And if you remember ribonucleotide reductase, you have the enzyme, which can be damaged itself, but also that you have to have a faithful electron donor system in order to get the enzyme running. If you oxidize the thiols in the cell, that will be a problem, and then you won't have DNA repair. Of course, you won't have DNA replication. And that may be not only proteins, but also DNA being damaged.